Welcome to This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, there's a new Ernie in town. Like Doctor Who, the premium bond generator had its fifth incarnation this week using quantum technology. So today we'll be taking a look at how best to manage a big windfall. Also, what's the best way to help your kids out financially, and how to make sure your own investment portfolio provides for you in retirement. Oh, and I get to go on a secret mission to Bletchley. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Now you can start saving from just £25. Millions of tax-free prizes every month.
Now, this week saw the launch of the new Ernie machine. It's come a long way from its 1950s beginnings. We'll talk about that more later on. But it got us musing on perhaps a rather nice problem to have, what you should do if you suddenly get a large amount of money. Now, a windfall, of course, can come as a result of a number of things: inheritance, sale of business, a house, and, yes, a premium bond win. But Simon, before we get to the nitty-gritty, I suppose it's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah, the size of a windfall and how much of a windfall difference that makes depends on how much you have in your bank account to start with, I guess. If you are someone who is already relatively wealthy, then an inheritance of, say, £100,000 may not feel like a particularly life-changing sum. It's certainly not something to be sniffed at. However, if you are someone whose bank balance is flirting more with the lower numbers, or even zero, then £100,000 is going to make a huge difference. But even further down the scale, so we often talk about windfalls, we talk about very large amounts, but even if you've got relatively low savings, a couple of £1,000 is going to make a big difference to someone.
I was actually thinking about this on the way over, Georgie, because tonight there's 40 guaranteed millionaires in the Euro Millions. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be nice to have £1 million? And then what would you do with it? And how would you sort of like divvy it up and process it? And I think we all have those thoughts about what you would do with a big windfall. And you're right, you know, it's all relative to your own personal situation and your own finances. I would suggest that a five-figure sum for most would be, you know, the general public, is a nice windfall no matter what, you know, the circumstances. But
a couple of hundred quid is a nice windfall if you weren't expecting it, let's be honest. But you know, it makes a difference as to what decisions you make subsequently with that money.
What you do with the money is a different question, and what you should do to protect that cash depending on how much you earn or make or win.
I think that also it doesn't just depend on how much money you've got. It depends on where you live as well, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, that's the really obvious thing. I mean, I live in a not particularly posh part of London. It's a fairly scruffy bit that's on the edge of Zone 2/3. £1 million would just about get you a 3-bed terraced house. Whereas £1 million is going to go a lot further if you're living somewhere like Yorkshire.
What are the first things to think about then if you do get a windfall?
I guess you need to think about what you want to do with it and how you want to treat that windfall. Do you want to bank that windfall, put it into your savings? Do you want to put that windfall towards moving to a bigger property? A lot of people, I think, if they got a big sum, would think, right, I'm going to move house to a more expensive property. You've got to remember that more expensive property, if it's bigger, is probably going to cost you more to run, so you might need to set aside some money for that. Or they might think, actually, do you know what? This is money that I wasn't expecting. I'm going to spend it. I think personally, I would maybe look to spend a bit of it. I think it's always good to spend a bit of it. Treat yourself. Spend a bit of it.
Snowboarding.
I don't know. It depends how much money it was. Maybe on a big holiday.
Tesla.
No, I wouldn't. Do you know what? I tell you what. If I got a big windfall, I would never buy a brand new car, because the problem with new cars is they depreciate. I would be more likely to go buy a second-hand car, go buy a classic car, one that I would think would hold its value or go up in value. I'd definitely, if it was a large enough sum of money, probably think about putting the bulk of it towards moving home. If it wasn't that kind of large enough sum of money, then I'd probably think about trying to save or invest it. The problem is when it comes to investing, lots of people always say, oh, well, I'm not an investor. I might be an investor when I've got more money. The more money you've got, the bigger the concern is that you invest it into something and suddenly the value goes down sharply. So I think you'd want to drip feed it in. But I definitely think that I would spend some of it.
OK, well, ignoring spending some of it, because I think we all probably would, therein lies the rub, you know, saving, investing, or perhaps you would buy property. And I'm going to say the B word.
Breakfast.
But with Absolutely. What are you having for breakfast with your new windfall? No, Brexit, of course.
Something I think that we should note today is now happening this month.
It is now happening this month.
I realised that when listening to the radio today and they said with less than 1 month to go towards Brexit. And I was like, wow, it's actually happening this month. Well, or maybe
or
not
maybe
happening.
Not, exactly.
But it's actually meant to be happening this month. But
Three weeks is ages.
That's a
lifetime away.
But with that, be that as it may, whether it's this month or it's coming any time down the horizon, there are political uncertainties having an impact, as we've spoken already, on things like investments, on house prices at the moment. Mm-hmm. So people will be thinking, traditionally perhaps, an English man and woman's home is his castle. We do love our property, don't we? But is that such a great idea to invest there with any money you might have at the moment?
It all depends. If we're talking about...
Just sit tight with it?
It depends if you're talking about moving up yourself, you know, moving up the property ladder into a bigger home because that's what you need and want. If we're talking about buying second properties and buy-to-let properties, obviously it's become way less attractive than it once was to get into that kind of market. So, you know, people would have serious reservations, I would suggest now, to start just snapping up properties, thinking that it's as good an investment as it once was. We've seen house prices, especially in London and the South East, growth has sort of dipped and is slowing. You know, I don't know how much of a great investment that is. But then we're talking about over the long term, you know, property over the long term, if we look back over the last 20, 30 years, of course, property prices have gone up. So it's very difficult to say, is that the right investment and that's what you should go for? It all depends about your short-term and long-term view. If you've got a big windfall, you know, you probably want to sort of mix up and have a bit of a diverse portfolio. You probably want to look at putting some of it into investing. You probably want to look at it, some of it going into savings accounts that are, you know, pay less returns, but the risk is, you know, far smaller. And on that note, it is actually quite imperative that you split the cash around, because the Financial Services Compensation Scheme would protect you up to £85,000 per banking licence. Now, what that can mean, let's say you've received that theoretical £1 million, actually, you shouldn't really hold it all into one savings account or one bank. Firstly, because the effect of inflation on that is not going to be great. And secondly, because of the risk of a bank or building society or wherever you hold your cash going under and you not having the full protection. And we saw that in the financial crisis. You know, some of the big banks that you would never have thought might fail were on the brink. So there's always worth bearing that in mind. And actually, NS&I itself has quite a popular account, which is the Direct Saver, which protects people's money up to the tune of £2 million. So if you won a premium bond, say, that £1 million jackpot, putting it in its Direct Saver, which pays 1%, although 1% isn't great, on a large sum of money, you know, there's nothing to be sniffed at. And it could be a place for short-term sort of stability where you're deciding what to do with such a big windfall. I think that's worth pointing out. But elsewhere, most savings providers are protected up to £85,000. So it's really important to remember that.
Is that a good idea to hold fire at when it's a time like this, Simon?
I think probably if people were thinking about investing a large sum, they might be thinking of holding fire. You wouldn't be able to buy a property between now and March 29th anyway. So if you're going to live there long-term, then, as Lee said, it doesn't necessarily matter so much if you're making an investment. But here's a question, right? It's about the windfall thing. So what would you do if you got a windfall of £1 million, £50,000, and if you got a windfall of £10,000?
All of them I would put towards buying a home.
Would you put all of it towards buying a home?
No,
with a million.
Simon, let's not be ridiculous. And probably not even with 10,000. No, that's terribly irresponsible. Yeah, no, I would probably go on holiday. But the first thing I would do is I would get myself a financial advisor.
That's probably a good idea,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, there we go. And the rest would be for them to rein me in on what I would like to do.
Lee, million, 50, 10?
£1 million, I would definitely start looking at divvying some of it up between sort of friends and family members. So my mum, who helped me out massively throughout my university years.
You're making me feel bad now.
I would be...
I'd be
earmarking 10% for her. She's recently retired and, you know, she doesn't have a huge pension. So I would definitely earmark. I'd be looking at it in sort of like 5 to 10% increments. So I'd be looking at 10% perhaps for my mum. I'd be looking at building my daughter's future, making sure that she's got a nice chunk for when she turns 18 or a little bit older than that. I would definitely... you know, I love a holiday. I would definitely do perhaps a world around the world trip, just for something for me. And I think the rest of it, I would hold back and have a good mix of trying to get an annual return to over supplement my income, it would definitely be £1 million. It'd be supplement. I wouldn't be able to retire, but I would definitely look at how I could turn that into a sort of 10-15 grand annual boost.
Yeah,
it's funny listening to Lee talking there, because it makes me realise, with us living in the south and around London, how skewed our minds must be by house prices, just what £1 million actually means. Because only when listening to Lee, you realise what a huge amount of money that is.
Yes, because it'd be really easy to do your whole million on a house,
yeah,
wouldn't
absolutely.
It?
Yeah, easily, and not yeah. get a huge amount for it in relative terms.
We'll have people listening to us who live in other parts of the country spluttering into whatever they've got
yeah,
in front of them,
exactly.
going, what are these maniacs talking about?
It's an extraordinary amount of money.
I wouldn't buy a property. I wouldn't even pay off the home that I own at the moment, because mortgage rates are pretty good. It's all manageable.
If you know what it's like to live in a property, own it and have it and it be yours, I think there's a difference. But
for 100%.
For someone like, you know, who spends all of their working life renting, to own your own home, there is something, some kind of emotional attachment to that. So, yeah, I think for me that would be a first priority. I wouldn't go nuts.
What would you do, Simon? We definitely need a bigger home. So we are creaking at the seams in ours. We are on a one-in, one-out basis for any new belongings, basically.
You're talking about the kids.
We're definitely on a one-in, one-out basis for any more of them. I would put up to half of it, I reckon, towards moving to a bigger house and doing that probably with a relatively small mortgage. As Lee says, it's actually, you could probably actually get a better return from investing the money than the amount that it would cost you on the mortgage. So yeah, with a relatively small mortgage, I'd definitely look to spend some of it. I reckon maybe I'd spend £50,000. Might give some of it to my family members, brothers and sisters, things like that. Then I would look to kind of save or invest a big chunk of it. And what I would look to do with that money is maybe have it somewhere that I could then do something that would set myself up to start my own business or something like that. So you could then grow it into the future. I think you'd have to take some form of risk with that money in order to start growing it in the future. And I'd want to probably try to use it productively. I think it's interesting that on £1 million, none of us have said I'd retire.
No.
So realistically, if you use the 4% rule, which is one that's widely used, you could take about 4% without running down the lump sum that you have, thanks to the kind of investment returns that you could get. You could take a £40,000 income from that. That's quite a lot of money. Most people would be pretty happy with that. You've got to bear in mind that you could probably do that pretty much tax free from a £1 million premium bonds price, for example. But that's relying on you not having put any of that money into a house, given it to anyone else, done all those other things I've talked about. And the moment you start doing that, you start eating into that income. Yeah. Then with the £50,000 one, I think, again, I'd definitely spend some of it. Maybe I'd spend 5 or 10, and put the rest of it towards savings or investments or something. Maybe put it towards helping me to move home. With the £10,000 one, I think, again, I'd probably look to spend some of it. Maybe I'd spend 2 grand or something. Maybe go on a nice big family holiday. And then the rest of it, I'd try to do something useful with. I'd definitely try to be prudent, I think, with the bulk of any windfall that I got, rather than blow it all.
Now, you might want to give some of your windfall to your children. There's been a lot that's written, hasn't there, about student loans. Let's finally put this to bed as whether this is a good or a bad idea. But also, I mean, there are other options you can do. You can put it into their pension. You can give them money to get started investing. So there's loads of different options you can do. But to put it to bed, finally, Lee, is it a good or an awful, awful idea, as lots of people are suggesting, to even think about paying off your kid's student loan?
My hunch is that it's not a particularly good idea. But it all depends, as we always say, on your personal circumstances and how it all stacks up for your own family. The thing is, with university now, it's obviously way more expensive than when we went to university by some considerable distance, which means that there's definitely way more of an argument perhaps to be considering paying down some more of that student loan. The issue is that most people that are in that position to do that have probably been helped in some way before they go to university with the bulk or some of or all of their fees. So it's very hard to then say to someone, you know, if you've got a windfall, I mean, would you want to? It's such a dull thing to have to pay off, isn't it, if you've got 50 grand student debt? But it is also hanging over your head.
I mean, it's also the repayments are all contingent on how much you earn. And exactly. So eventually, after 30 years, you may not have to pay it all back exactly. If you don't earn above a certain amount.
So you may not even end up paying it all off. That's the thing.
Like, and if you'd invested that £50,000 at the start.
Exactly that. And then you might have had enough. You know, that is the main argument, to be honest with you, Georgie. That's why a lot of people look at it and go, it's actually no
it's a better
point.
Way of doing it.
You know, I've looked at my own, I've still got student debt. So I finished university in 2008. So we're talking 11 years ago. I've still got five figure student loan. And I went when tuition fees were £1,200. And I was helped with funding and stuff because I was from a single parent family. So I still came out, I still racked up quite a huge debt, and yeah. I'm still getting that sucked out of my paycheck week in, week out, as I have done for many years now, and it's slowly, slowly starting to trickle away. But I'm still going to be, it's still going to take probably another 4 or 5 years before that's fully paid off. It's a long old time, and I'm talking about finishing before tuition fees are now up to £9,000 a year. So you think that before you start is 27 grand, then you've got the cost of living, depending on whereabouts you go and study, that can vary massively. If you're studying in London and the southeast, again, probably going to be another £20,000 premium on that, because halls are more expensive, the cost of living is more expensive. And then you start to look at that and you see that figure. That's the panic, I think. A lot of people see that figure and they're worried about it. And then, especially now because interest is higher than it was as well from previous systems, it is quite scary. And I do think actually there needs to be some changes in the way that that's shown and illustrated in your annual sort of statement, as it were. So you get an annual statement of your student loan and it never quite gives you a forecast of how much longer you've got to pay off.
Oh yeah, they need to sort that out. It's so archaic. Figures as well.
It's so archaic. And then actually tracking down like lost passwords to go onto the system and all that sort of stuff.
I had to go through this last year because I finally paid it off and discovered they owed me about £2,500.
It's really tough. But I would say in the large bulk of circumstances, it's not really worth paying off a student loan. But that's not a concrete answer. There never is an absolute yes or no answer to this in my mind. Simon might view otherwise.
And if you have, and I'll ask Simon in a sec, but if you have that money and that's what you want to do, then, you know, that is your prerogative to do so. One of the arguments that I do want to ask you, because we just touched on it there, is the psychological impact. A lot of the argument being, you know, what is the psychological impact of leaving university with this huge debt? Mm-hmm. I have to say, having paid this off last year, finally, and I'm not too much older than you, Lee, did I notice it so much? Did it weigh on me? No, not really. I've paid it off, does it make life any different? Not really.
I find it quite a burden. I think almost like a spectre looming all the time in the background. Yeah, you know, it's quite a...
I look at it like large national insurance or something.
It's a large sum of money to be earning, and if it's starting to get sapped out of your paycheck month in, month out, especially I'm feeling it more now with a new child, I'm feeling it more with cost of commuting going up, all of that sort of stuff gets taken out of my salary.
Surely
you know,
you've never known it before. No, and when
it ends, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be like, you know, bonus pay. It's like getting a pay rise. But I think psychologically, it's always there lingering. And a lot of our younger generations are starting life, you know, in the red because it's hanging there. And that puts pressure on, I think, to find yourself a good paying job, perhaps in something that you don't particularly like. You feel like you need to, I don't know, maybe this is my own mindset, but that feeling of student debt being sat there just isn't a particularly nice feeling. It's a way better feeling than if it was on a credit card or on a personal loan or another form of debt, just because the interest rates we're talking about are far lower than that. But it's still...
Any debt is psychological.
This is what annoys me about the student loan companies, the fact that, as I was just saying, there's no forecast of actually saying this is when this is going to be paid off. All I'm saying, it's like a spectre looming over. I know that I've got the repayment plan in place for it to disappear. And even if it didn't disappear, you know, what's the worst that's going to happen? It's just going to stick around until you're grey and old and it gets written off.
Simon?
Yours won't get written off, though, will it?
Under the new system, it gets written off.
Some
technicality, yeah.
So I know that there are some personal finance experts who are supportive of this scheme and say, don't worry about it, because lots of people will never actually end up paying it off. I think that's a really bad way to start people out in their financial life. I think that sounds like a credit card bill that you never actually pay off to me. I think that the student loan system is incredibly badly set up. I think it was a mistake to do this. I think we charge people far too much interest on it. When I took out my student loan, the idea was that effectively it was a kind of interest-free loan. And what happened was it just, the interest rate was inflation. So it's set in inflation. It was conveniently for the government set at RPI inflation, not CPI inflation, which, as everyone knows, is the official inflation measure and has been for a very long time. It's now up to 3% above RPI. And it's 3% above RPI while you're at university and you can't actually be earning any money to pay it off.
Yeah.
I mean, so at the moment, that's 6.3%. That is more expensive than almost any mortgage that you will find on the market.
You talk about personal loans and
credit cards. It's more expensive than most personal loans. Yeah. I have a credit card, a low-rate credit card. The rate on that isn't much more than 6.3%. So I think that's a terrible way to do it. And it's 9% of people's salary above £25,000. That is a noticeable amount. That's money that could be going into your pension. That's money that could be being saved for your first home and things like that. And I think now the debt is so big that it does weigh on people and does hang over them. And they will find that actually that they get offered smaller mortgages because mortgages are now assessed on affordability basis. And that student loan coming out of your paycheck and for 30 years is a draw on your earnings. And so you will effectively be offered a smaller mortgage. I mean, maybe that's good. Keeps a lid on house prices a little bit. But yeah, if you don't pay it off within 30 years, it gets cleared. So actually, for many people, maybe it isn't worth paying off. But we've got some figures here from this story that were run by AJ Bell. If your starting salary is £25,000 and your earnings go up by an average of 3% over that 30-year period, based on a £50,000 worth of loans, over the 30-year period, you will make total payments of £39,545. By the time you get to the end of the 30 years, your outstanding loan will be £155,149. Well, I mean, that's humongous, which will be written off. So basically, you'll be up by £10,455. That's the difference between your the amount of payments you've made and what you borrowed. If your starting salary is £35,000, you'll make total payments of £82,362. Your outstanding loan will be £115,000. Pounds, and you will lose £32,353 because you'll have paid that much more in repayments.
Those figures are actually really quite scary, and I guess I'm looking at it from a more point of view from sort of our generation and beyond, actually the younger generation. That is absolutely, I mean, that's scary. I rewind a little bit here when I was saying about, you know, student loan rates not being like personal loan rates, but for that is pure madness. I didn't actually quite realise how high that figure is.
In the unlikely event that you have a starting salary of £45,000, your total repayments over 30 years would be £125,180. And you'd still end up with a loan outstanding of £30,783 at the end.
Wow.
So you'd be £75,000 down. I don't really understand how you could pay 125 grand back on 50 grand and you'd still end up owing £31,000. After 30 years. So I guess if you've got a child who is going into, you know, a city law firm or some kind of high-paying job, then actually, ironically, it probably makes sense to pay it off. Now, you would hope, as we were talking before about, that you could get a better return on your money from investing it. But actually, RPI plus 3% sets the bar pretty high there. So it would be quite difficult to get a better return
what's happened
from
to
investing
what's
it.
What's happened to higher education in this country?
I don't know, but I tell you what, there is a problem here. And one of the problems here is that this has been the reason why it's said that we can't get rid of this system is because of social mobility, and because what it will mean is that universities will have to offer less places, and offering less places disproportionately affects those on lower incomes who are less likely to go to university in that case. I'm not sure how that stands up, but I do know that the universities have massively expanded off the back of this. There are questions over the finances of some of the universities, not necessarily the big name ones. I think that we will see a university go bust in the not too distant future. And also, I have a story here. Number of students getting first class degrees skyrockets as universities is accused of grade inflation, making a Desmond almost extinct. The Desmond Tutu.
The Desmond, yeah.
Yeah, and so basically, some universities are dishing out 50% of sort of first class degrees. I mean, it's crazy. What this does is obviously it devalues the degrees of all the people who came before them. And I think that off the back of this system, we've ended up in a little bit of a mess in our universities, and we probably need to try and do something to fix it.
I think we probably should. I didn't expect us to go quite down that political rabbit hole, but let's look at some of the other options then. We're talking about windfalls and what you would do with that money if you don't want to put it all to paying off their student loan. What about helping them with the mortgage? What about putting in their pension or helping investing?
Okay, helping them with the mortgage, I guess that's really giving them a deposit, isn't it? So you've got that lump sum, you give them the deposit. To be honest, that's probably going to be the thing that most helps most people, and they're going to feel most beneficial. Probably as many people who could be a potential first-time buyer who'd rather own their own home than have the student loan paid off. They say, well, student loan's my problem. Yes, it's eating into my income. So that's probably a helpful thing. Investing, I think giving them some money to start them investing, and then helping them get started investing is maybe a good idea, because it sets people on that path. And then if you give your children some money or your grandchildren some money to help them start investing, then they're more likely to invest some money themselves alongside it.
All right, then. Enough about the kids, Simon. What about you? Or, in fact, your reader, Brian, 57. He wants to make sure his own investment portfolio can withstand market downturns and provide him with a good income at retirement. So this is all part of your Money Pit Stop series. What information did you give to Brian?
Okay, so Brian is 57, married, and lives in Lancashire. He's not appearing on Blind Date, which is what that made it sound like. He's got a final salary pension. Now, final salary pension is great because someone else is guaranteeing to pay you a certain amount of income for the rest of your life, and started drawing it from last year. He also took 25% of the pension as a tax-free lump sum, which amounts to £50,000. That leaves him with an annual income of £7,800. But he isn't fully retired. He holds a part-time position with his local council, paying £4,600 a year. And he has £24,000 in invested assets, £22,000 of which is invested in a SIP, which is a self-invested personal pension, and also £1,500 in savings. And he doesn't get his state pension until 2029. So he's got a while to go. Now, he's in the fortunate position where he has got this regular income coming in from the final salary pension. Mm-hmm. But he does have this windfall scenario, effectively. I mean, it's his money that's given him the windfall, but the pension lump sum that people get is akin to getting one of those windfalls that we were talking about earlier. I mean, £50,000 in one go is something that doesn't happen to you very often in your life. And then you've got to try and work out what to do with it. So the advice that's been given to him here is firstly to look at the bigger picture, to look at how much money he might need in retirement. What's the income he needs to match the outgoings that he's going to have? And to bear in mind that he's going to have to wait 10 years for his state pension. Once that state pension kicks in, it will give a nice little boost to his income, but he's got to get through the gap there. And once he's got a better understanding of how much money he might need, he can then try and work out how he's going to fulfill that. And one of the things that he said he was interested in is protecting his investments from a downturn. And the advice that we've got here from Patrick Connolly, who is an advisor at Chase de Vere, financial planner at Chase de Vere, says the best way for him to grow his money but also have some protection against market downturns is through asset diversification, i.e. not putting all your eggs in one basket, by holding other investments such as fixed interest, that's bonds, and property alongside shares. That helps him to spread the risks, because nobody knows for sure which investments will perform well in the future. But also that if markets do fall, it's important to stay calm and rational. Many people make investment decisions based on short-term performance or sentiment, meaning they often buy at the top of the market when sentiment is positive and sell at the bottom when it's negative, something we've commented on many times before here. So basically, adopt a long-term strategy and stick to it. And if he's worried about a big fall in the markets, to drip feed his £50,000 lump sum in. Because then that means that it's not, he'll put it in one day, market crashes tomorrow, and then he's in trouble.
That's Brian, but you also have anonymously, last week we spoke about these money diaries, and Lee, you said you wanted the contributors to be anonymous. Mm-hmm. And it's basically millennials, and we don't like the term millennials, but younger people's
18
issues.
18 to 35 year olds.
Thank
yeah.
you, 18 to 35 mm-hmm. year olds. And you have your first money diary up, published, mm-hmm. and I just want you to tell me what this post was, what it represents, I suppose. It's the first one.
Yes, exactly. So we've launched our This Is Money Diaries. It's written by Grace Gorston, who's one of our new reporters. And actually, the reason we've launched it is we realised that a lot of younger people actually access their financial sort of advice, so to speak, via Money Diary. So what it is an anonymous account of someone's monthly spend from their current account, what they're spending money on, what their financial concerns are, what their goals are, and with the aim of just giving some, you know, tips and some pointers of where they could go to perhaps help themselves out financially, achieve their goals, and stop the anxieties that they're feeling. So in our first post this week, as a 28-year-old earning £25,000 a year, she has a stocks and shares ISA, she has a lifetime ISA, and she has a savings account that pays 0.1%, which is an instant instant red flag. So it's the sort of things that we're kind of looking at and analysing and seeing where money can work harder. Interestingly, she told us, so she rents in London, which as we know is expensive, but actually she has £300 per month that she can put aside, which she's doing very well when you consider that she's on £25,000 a year and you think about the cost of living. Some of the takeaways from it and some of the things that she said, I actually found not upsetting, but it sort of hit me a little bit. And one of those was, she said, whenever I make a purchase, I feel an immense amount of guilt and will agonise over spending money on things, asking myself over and over, do I really need it?
Wow.
And actually it shows, it highlights that, you know, millennials aren't just going around spending on avocados and coffees and, you know, listen to the last week's podcast when we passionately spoke about younger people's finances. But you know, another thing she said is, I feel like I'm spinning financial plates. At any moment, one could fall and smash. I mean, that's quite a sad thing to hear for someone in their 20s, that they're concerned about their finances in that kind of manner. She feels sort of not pressurized, but wants to get on the property ladder with her partner. It's not easy, even with £300 per month to be putting away.
Anyone who's been in a situation where they feel like, I mean, you're a new dad, they're spinning plates in whatever regard. Psychologically, how does that make you clear and focused on work, on life, giving your best? You know, there's sort of an irony to the fact that when you need to sort out your finances and you're worried about them, it makes it even more difficult for you to do it.
And what this shows as well, and what we want to encourage, is the dialogue around, don't be ashamed, don't feel, you know, we want to shine the light. There's going to be loads of other people that are in the same boat that are feeling like this. And what we want to do is help guide people into making, you know, make their money working harder and actually realizing that there are other people in the same boat. There are other people that are feeling anxious about their money situation in their 20s, in their 30s, in their late teens. And we just want to get their voice heard. We want to get their monthly spending shown and to basically help as many people as we can improve their financial lifestyle.
What help was given to this contributor?
Well, we analysed what she was spending, and actually it involved a little bit of, she's adamant that she wants to get on the property ladder, so she wasn't putting enough into her lifetime ISA. She was focusing more on her stocks and shares ISA, which had a risk rating of 4 out of 10. We sort of looked at it, and you know, this isn't financial advice. This is more of us sort of like steering and guiding where we believe there might be better value. Now, if she's thinking about, she really wants to get onto the property ladder, the lifetime ISA, although I've berated it in the past, actually between her and her partner, it's kind of worth maxing that out, because at the end of the day, it's going to be a guaranteed 25% return on the money each year, which on a stocks and shares ISA is very unlikely that you're going to achieve, but only up to a certain point. So it's not like you can save tens of thousands of pounds in it. But what I looked at and thought is that you should be probably paying more into that to help build up that deposit pot a bit quicker. We obviously told her to get that money out of that savings account that was paying 0.1%. She had a few thousand pounds in there, which could, you know, it's just stale money. It's doing nothing. You know, it's just the bank. That's back to why the banks are winning, because your money's just stuck in there doing nothing. So, you know, move that around. We had a look at some of the monthly spending. So, for instance, we saw that the internet bill was something like £42 or £43 a month. I mean, that's a lot for the internet. You can be cutting that down.
Back to old fashioned switching,
you know, it's that loyalty penalty probably, you know, been with them for a while and not looked shopped around or phoned up and haggled a better deal. And also she was saying about her pension, which she mentioned in there, that she was worried that she's not going to have enough for retirement, and that's where she was getting mixed up, and that's why I don't like this lifetime ISA, because she was getting a little bit mixed up as to whether she should be using lifetime ISA as a pension pot or she should be using it to buy a property. I don't know how you can have a product that's doing the both. I find it so strange. It's such a strange concept to have a product that's, I would have thought that 95% of people are using it as to buy a first-time property.
I would say you only really use it or have it if you want to buy a property. If you don't use it to buy a property, well, you've still got a little bit of money, but that shouldn't and you replace can't the pension,
you can't,
surely.
You can't access that for a long time. Yeah. So what she was saying is that she was putting £50 a month into her pension, because that's the maximum that her employer would match it to. So that's like £100 a month. But, you know, what we pointed out in this is actually you've got time, and it does amount up once you've got tax relief and stuff in there. It's taken from pre-tax pay and all of that sort of stuff. Actually, focus on getting on that property ladder, because that's what you want and that's what you want to do. Continue to be paying it into that pension at that rate, and then hopefully you'll get a pay increase. Hopefully you'll be able to start upping that pension contribution. And that's the kind of flavour of what we're doing with this This Is Money Diaries. We just want to sort of, as I say, highlight that people are in this boat. There's going to be loads of people that are earning that sort of money. They've got different products dotted around. They're not really too sure what to do with it, how to achieve their goals, how to alleviate the fears that they have. And it's just about some simple guidance on some simple changes that could be made, hopefully, to help build towards those goals and get rid of those anxieties.
Yeah, I wrote my column about this this week on the sort of like saying, don't just bash these people. What is it that people can learn from the younger generation? What would you tell the younger generation, but also the older generation can learn from the younger generation?
Yeah.
Trying to want to get their head around what it's like for them. But there's two comments on here. I'll just read them out because I quite like these. One of them is by someone calling them So Lost in Leicestershire, who says, to be honest, as a boomer, i.e. a baby boomer, myself, life wasn't that bad. I bought a flat in London for 2 times my wage, not 10 times like today. I also got tax relief on the interest. It cost me £39,000 at the time and would cost £500,000 today. I also took a couple of holidays a year, ate out once or twice a week. Life was sweet. Now I'm 62 and about to take the final salary pensions I've accrued over the years. Life is still sweet, although I don't take sugar in my tea anymore. Mm-hmm. Yes, I've worked hard from time to time, but only because the reward made it very worthwhile. Not sure you can say that for today's average Joe, Josephine. Seems they have to bust a gut just to get by. Oh. Which is a good comment. There's another good comment from here from someone, Lost123 in Luton, who says that they think they're Generation X. So that's like 40s kind of thing. Says, my advice is, whilst you're in your 20s, try and have some fun. You'll have the rest of your working lives to worry about mortgage payments, stay renting and move jobs. Build up a good base for your career pyramid. Move where the opportunities are. You're a long time in work. Try and make that work as interesting as you can. The rest will fall into place. Take chances. Once you get the partner, children, whatever, you will have to compromise, not be able to move so easily. So take those chances now. Travel whilst your body is healthy. Go out dancing. Your 20s are your best years. Don't waste them worrying.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
Now, this week saw the launch of the new Ernie machine, as we mentioned a little bit earlier. It's not just Lee, though, who gets to leave the office and go on little jaunts. Last week I grabbed my knapsack and off I went in search of the past. OK, so we've just taken the train up to Bletchley. I'm joined by Chris Dowsett from NS&I, all very shrouded in mystery, as you'd expect from Bletchley. Why have we come up here, Chris?
Well, we've come up to Bletchley to see the very first Ernie One and how Ernie worked, the history of Ernie, and get some sounds from the Ernie One machine.
What does Ernie do, then? What's he for?
Well, now, when the idea of premium bonds was first thought of, it meant finding a way of indicating prize winners in a completely uncontrolled, random manner, which would be scrupulously fair. The electronic random number indicator equipment, Ernie, was the result.
I'm Ian Ackerley. I'm Chief Executive of National Savings and Investments. Premium bonds have been around for over 60 years. They are our best-loved product and the biggest single savings product in the UK. We've got over 21 million customers, and we've got somewhere around about 68 billion invested in it. The reason it remains popular is because of the fun. I think people really get a buzz out of winning prizes. And there's something delightful about the fact that every month there are 2 new millionaires in the UK, courtesy of premium bonds.
Mr. Bloom is a recent premium bond prize winner, and he's kindly volunteered to tell us about his success.
Well, my wife had a lifelong ambition to visit America, and I thought this would be a wonderful opportunity.
Did you enjoy your trip?
Oh, yes, I had a wonderful time.
And what about you, Mr. Bloom? Have you bought any more premium bonds?
Oh, yes, indeed.
My name is Agent Million. It's my role to go and deliver the £1 million prize to jackpot winners. We pay over 3 million tax-free prizes each month, ranging from £25 right up the way to £1 million. I wouldn't call in advance. I'll simply knock on your door and I'll ask to speak to you. A typical reaction is of surprise and delight. People are always in shock. They just can't quite believe that they've won. Some people can get quite emotional. Some people cheer with joy, I've even had an elderly lady actually swear out loud, which, you know, I wasn't expecting at the time. It usually does take a while for the news to sink in. I'll let them know that I'll get back in touch the following day just to check how they are. One thing I always do is apologise for a bad night's sleep, because I've not actually come across anyone that's been able to sleep, but it can vary really with the reactions.
So we're walking up to the National Museum of Computing.
Yes, this is where we rebuilt Ernie One for the 60th anniversary a couple of years ago. So we've come to see that, how it works, and how we've moved from Ernie One to Ernie Five. Hi Phil, how are you doing?
Yeah, great.
Good.
How are you?
Yes,
yeah?
Very
good.
Well, thank you.
My name's Phil Hayes. I'm the Chief Colossus Engineer, and I'm responsible for keeping Colossus running. In the room here is going to be where the new Ernie exhibition will be housed. I'll just give you an overview what is here. This is our recreation of the demonstration equipment that the Postmaster General Charles Hill used to demonstrate how electronic noise can be used to produce random numbers.
And making them take the form of Bond serial numbers. He does it all of his own accord. Nothing is fed into him. He's not like a computer. And he's been tested and his results analysed and proved truly random.
It looks like a wardrobe.
Yeah, it looks a bit like a wardrobe. It's made of wood. At the top you have two noise generators, the same design as what's used in the original Ernie One, and the output of those two noise generators go to two displays, and those displays show two random numbers. It was designed in 56. First draw was in 1957.
I'd like you to meet Mr. and Mrs. Shum, who just returned after 4 weeks in Madeira. Mr. Shum was a £500 premium bond prize winner. Now, Mr. Shum, was this a pleasure trip or a health trip or what?
I hadn't been feeling too well, and the doctor thought I ought to get away for a bit.
And your £500 win helped to pay for it?
It certainly did, and a bit over. Here's a photograph I was taking.
It was state-of-the-art at that time. Literally state-of-the-art. And Ernie One was the very first machine that Dollis Hill built with these printed wiring boards. And today, everybody has printed circuit boards in every piece of electronics going.
Do we get to hear it?
I've got to turn the amplifier on first. That's going to take a few seconds to warm up.
So it's generating numbers. That's a 2 and an 8. 3 and 1. Every time that happens, the little white discs with numbers from 0 to 9 around them, and the bulbs flash all the way around, and then they will stop when the music stops or the sound stops. And then you get your numbers generated. How have the subsequent Ernies changed? Have they just built on the technology?
Well, the technology today, in here, the noise generators, inch and a quarter round, 3 inches long, and that's a single one. Today, you could put those, the equivalent, in the palm of your hand and probably have many millions of them.
It's a bit like Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. So periodically, there is a new Ernie. So every month, it generates a huge number of numbers, which are then matched to bonds, which then become prizes. Now, as the book has got bigger, that task has got more and more difficult to do, and therefore we need to keep upgrading the equipment.
Chris, what is in my hand right now?
So, in your hand right now is a prototype chip for what Ernie 5 will actually look like. This will go into a motherboard that will then draw out the numbers that Ernie 5 will generate. As you can see, this chip is probably about the size of a grain of rice. But this will be responsible for drawing out about the 8 million numbers that we need for the 3 million prizes that get drawn out each month.
Very, very different to the wardrobe size Ernie One effort we've got in front of us.
The first ever draw took about 30 hours to complete. The first ever draw that Ernie Five will do takes 16 minutes to do the whole draw.
So the technology then, in here.
It's amazing, isn't it? Absolutely amazing.
In the palm of my hand. What was it about Ernie that captured your imagination?
Well, I was brought up with Ernie, when I got into electronics, Ernie was always in the back of my mind. I had this fascination about this machine. And at that time, it was still all classified. And that stayed with me up until about 2003, I suppose. Didn't know much about the machine, still thought it was secret. And then I found out that the machine, Ernie 1, still existed in the Science Museum. And then I started to do some research, and I realised that all the documentation on Ernie 1 had been released. And I basically got my hands on it and started to read it, realised how important the machine was, and I hope to get it up here at the National Museum of Computing.
Phil, thank you so much for showing us.
You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you want to get in contact with us, if you want to contribute to the Money Diaries or a Money Pit Stop or any other issue you want to comment on, Simon?
Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. If you want to join in the conversation, tweet us at thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast and you can tell us how you would spend that windfall and have a conversation with other people in the comments.
Fantastic. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.